Good evening. It is Monday, the 11th of January 2016, a day which is particularly significant to some of us. Now, we are gathered here today because we have just recorded a podcast about Arsenal for the Gooner. However, three of us that took part are big David Bowie fans, and this is, of course, the day when the news was announced that he sadly passed away. So, with no particular format, we're just going to talk for a bit about our memories. My name is Kevin Witcher. I'll leave the other guys to introduce themselves. However, I will tell you that I started getting into David Bowie around about 1973, and I've got a lot of memories of the man and his music, which I will be relaying over the next half hour or so. I will now hand over to the slightly more experienced Bowie fan on my left to introduce himself.
My name's Steve Ashford. I've been a Bowie fan. It's a bit like saying I've been an alcoholic for so long. I've been a Bowie-holic since 1970 when I first discovered the great man, and mortified at his passing. Can't tell you how bad today's been. It's actually been like losing a family member. And I sometimes wonder if life is ever going to be the same again.
Thanks, Dave. I'm Mark Ollington. I'm a slightly bit younger than the other two panel members here today. So my introduction to David Bowie wasn't until 1985, when I was watching the Live Aid show from start to finish, not really knowing very much about pop music at the age of nine, until some chap early evening came on called David Bowie, performed four songs that blew me away. I thought, who is this guy? This is just amazing. And from that point on, as a nine-year-old young lad, I bought every single Bowie album. And if you think some of my earliest albums were by Tin Machine, I stayed with him to the late days, which proved I grew to love the man an awful lot. So today's been, yes, a bad day for me, very much.
Just horrendous. No, the sad thing is that Bowie, when he made this new album, obviously, which is all about death and melancholy, he must have known that he was, had terminal cancer, and kept it from all of us, apart from his family. And I'm lucky enough to work for Sony, so, I kind of hear things from Bowie's side of the camp and from America and stuff, but no one I ever spoke to, and I have spoken to his managers and stuff like that, no one ever said, Bowie is seriously ill, If everyone said, oh, how's David? Oh, he's fine, never been better, And for Bowie to keep that secret, it's just tantamount to what a great guy he is. He didn't want to share his misery with his fans. He wanted to keep it private and keep it to himself. And the way that this new album has been received has been, brilliant. And when you look at that last video to the latest single, Lazarus, when you look at the video and it's Bowie, and we're probably starting at the end here, we'll go back to the beginning a bit later, but it's Bowie laying on a single bed with a mask on, and he lays on the bed, sings a few lyrics which you think are a bit about, not coming back and not being around and stuff. And then at the end of that video, he walks backwards into a cupboard and closes the door. I mean, and that is my last memory of Bowie. And he's walking into that cupboard, closing the door on his career and his life. And really, really, really sad.
When you watch it again after knowing that, I've got the album on Friday. Yeah. So on a Friday, it was a very different state of affairs. I got back from work, bought a bottle of wine, got the vinyl album, put on my earphones, and all weekend was spent listening to...
You're lucky to get the vinyl.
I got the vinyl from Amazon, Steve, not from DavidBowie.com that didn't ship the white version. I got the vinyl, and spent all weekend listening to it. I'll do with every Bowie album, playing it again and again and again. And I genuinely thought, even before he found out that he was dead, that it was a great album. I thought, isn't it amazing that a 69-year-old guy is making music as far out there as this? I thought it was brilliant. But then playing it today, coming here after hearing the news, you're right, every single song on that album has some mention of death or melancholy and everything else. Mm-hmm. And I was reading an interview today with a chap, I forget his name, but he did the stage play, Lazarus, with him. And he was one of the few guys that knew he had cancer. And he was saying the minute he found out it was terminal. Mm. He's like working on this album.
Yeah.
And it's his goodbye. Yeah. And when you listen to it after that,
yeah,
it's a heartbreaking album.
Yeah.
It really is.
I mean, how many other artists have made an album, written, produced, made videos, which is the best part of a year's work, knowing that they were probably going to be dead when it came out or die soon afterwards? Incredibly courageous. Well,
probably
to do that.
Only Freddie Mercury, who last Queen album was laced with,
yes,
certainly a lot of tunes relevant to his condition.
Yeah.
I mean, the interesting thing about that album just released for me is that, you know, the motivation behind it was obviously Bowie as an expressionist, as an artist, because there was no gain for him. You know, he's not going to make any money from this record.
No.
You know what I mean? He just made it because his life was as an artist who wrote and recorded songs and performed songs. And it's interesting that getting that kind of news that you've only got so many months or 18 months to live, I mean, he probably wasn't an exact time on it, motivated him to basically go back in the studio and put this out. And it's significant, I think, that it's only 2 or 3 days after that it actually was released that he died. It's like someone had a mission, needed to fulfil it, and then said, okay, now's the time, I can stop fighting.
Is Bowie's death, hate that word because it's so final, is Bowie's death as significant as Jimi Hendrix, John Lennon, to name but two?
Well, to me, Steve, it's more, but that's because I was a fan. And I think, you know, people often said that back in the day when he was in Tin Machine and stuff, had he died in 1980, well, that's what he should have done because his legacy would have been perfect. But what I really liked was the fact that after the years in the wilderness in the 80s, unlike many of his contemporaries like Elton John or Paul McCartney, he then went on to make albums that were relevant and actually meant something. And when The Next Day came out, what, 3 years ago, I mean, I liked Heaven and albums like that now, so I thought they were brilliant. But the critics embraced that album magnificently more than any other album by someone of a similar age.
Mm.
And I would argue that his legacy has far surpassed artists like that, because he had a longer career.
Yeah.
And he produced 30 albums. And there were missteps, you know, especially in the 80s. I mean, I love some of those 80s albums, but that's not an opinion shared by many people. But I'd argue that even though his 90s and 2000s work wasn't as consistent as his 70s work, there's some amazing songs there. And can Paul McCartney say the same thing?
No, and he was always trying as well to keep up with current trends. He probably criticised a bit for doing it. I mean, like Bowie aged 50-odd trying to do drum and bass.
With Earthly.
In Earthly, probably not good. And to try and be a bit indie and a bit punky with the Tin Machine probably didn't go down too well, but he carried on. It didn't, you know, he was always trying to keep up with the trends and stuff like that, like as he did in the 70s and 60s to a certain extent. But, you know, what would your favourite Bowie moment be, Mark?
Favourite Bowie moment? My word, what a question. I think as a moment, it had to be, and it's a very different morning than what we've had today, but it was 3 years ago when I presumed I wouldn't hear another album off him ever again. I was very happy and content with the albums that I had. But I was walking to work and my phone started going mental. There was texts and tweets and goes, "Have you heard it? Have you heard it?" And I'm going, "What are you talking about? Have I heard it?" And someone else went, "It's really brilliant. Have you heard it?" I thought, "What's going on?" Then my wife came up and said, "David Bowie's got a new single out." I thought, what? I got to work and there was a video. The internet was going crazy. It was obviously trending on Twitter, on every single news channel. And all these young kids at work, I say kids are in their 20s, but they were going, "Oh yeah, Mark, you know that Bowie guy. Have you heard his new single?" And it was one of the biggest comebacks ever. And as a Bowie fan, that was massively exciting. When, well, Where Are We Now came out after a 10-year gap.
Yeah.
And we all presumed he was very ill at that time. There were rumours that he was, like, you know, had after his heart attack problems. And he was in a really bad way. That was a very exciting moment.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I didn't particularly like that single.
I remember I chatted about it,
Didn't particularly like that. But other tracks on the album, Love is Lost, especially the Steve Klein remix.
The guy from LCD Sound System.
Oh yeah, my God,
James Murphy.
Love that track. Probably my favourite track in the last couple of years. Love it. It's in my car all the time. But no, I mean, going back to to Ziggy Stardust when you first heard that album. I mean, it was just incredible, wasn't it? When you that 5 years stuck on my tongue. I mean, what a great album that was! Totally groundbreaker. And I can remember when I first got that album, put it on my deck late at night, playing it again and again on the headphones, and drifting off to sleep with that album on repeat. You know, on the old, and the deck must have the arm must have gone into the middle, back to the outside, come on click, all through the night, slept through it, woke up to it, playing it again, you know. Always in my mind, that Ziggy Stardust, one of the greatest albums ever.
What's yours?
Well, I think my first real memories of Bowie are the most strong. I mean, when I was just getting into music as probably an 8 or 9 year old, Life on Mars was re-released as a single, or maybe released for the first time. I mean, it was certainly an album track in 71, I think.
Yeah, 73 as a single.
Yeah, and he just sounded like so brilliant and different from everything else. And then you see the video. Now, it was a time of glam rock, but it just wasn't as sort of... You know, he didn't play Top of the Pops by that time. I think he might have appeared on Top of the Pops once or twice early on, but he'd stopped appearing on Top of the Pops, so you had a video of Life on Mars. And he was like this figure that was slightly above and beyond the likes of most of the acts that were appearing, like Slade and Sweet or whatever, on Top of the Pops. And to an 8 or 9 year old, it was hugely impressionable. And then, to me... I then, you know, walking down the street and seeing in a record shop window the cover of Aladdin Sane was it just really so powerful, you know, and I just couldn't wait to hear that record. Although because of just sheer finance, I wasn't buying albums for many years to come, so I probably didn't hear the damn thing until about 1979-80. I just heard the singles on the radio, but. I sort of caught up with Bowie once I could afford to buy his music, and what really has made a big impression on me is the sheer variety of the musical styles he did and how good he was at them. You know, I mean, there's huge variety in his records right up to the end, and uniformly, there have been some duff tracks for sure, but there's always good ones.
I never liked Modern Love. Modern Love was the one Bowie track I could never get into.
Modern Love.
Everyone else seems to love it.
That's my wedding, Steve. It's one of the only songs that my wife actually enjoys by David Bowie. So,
really?
You know,
yeah. Oh, it's funny, isn't it? to me, that is the antipathy of any of Bowie's great work. If you look at all the stuff from Man Who Sold the World, and all that brilliant esoteric kind of psychedelic rocky stuff, and then compare it to Modern Love. I mean, it is the antithesis.
Well, Modern Love is a very commercial song, and in a way, that whole kind of that Let's Dance era was Bowie becoming commercial, and in a way, it was a phase he was going through.
Yeah.
In a way, it was his final kind of identity. He'd become a stadium superstar at that point, and he did that role wonderfully well, because he then went on to sell out, you know, a couple of stadium tours, maybe three. Sound of Vision was a stadium tour.
Glass Spider tour in 87.
And that was the way that music had actually gone then. Because in the 70s, there weren't too many stadium acts. Yeah. But by the 80s, it was becoming a more common thing. So Bowie adapted it. He dragged his back catalogue along and managed to remain commercially successful, even at a time when you could argue artistically that his records were not as good as they had been.
See, was that the first EMI album, the one with Let's Dance on it, that actually took Bowie from art superstar to major superstar, housewife superstar.
Totally agree. But I think, Steve, that was more by luck than judgment. And where I disagree with you, I guess, is that after Scary Monsters and a couple of years break, because up to that point being album year after year after year, and even 77, there was four albums, two by himself, two in Iggy Pop, you know, he was producing stuff at a massive rate. But he was a cult artist. Yeah. And he came back in 83 with this new deal with EMI after being on the RCA for 10 years.
Yeah.
And teamed up with Noel Rodgers from Chic to make this big bombastic pop album.
Yeah.
But I think that was him going from soul to, you know, ambient stuff to art rock, then trying pop. The problem with it was it became far more successful, that album, than what he thought it was going to be. And as Kev said, he was playing arenas up to that point. The album carried on selling, and the arenas turned into stadiums when it was only ever booked as like an arena tour, and ended up playing three nights at Milton Keynes Bowl. And then, to me, it's not Let's Dance that's the problem. It's then he become ultra famous and had Phil Collins fans as his fans. So the two subsequent albums, Tonight and Never Let Me Down, those are the two, not Let's Dance for me, that he thought, shit, I'm now a megastar.
Yeah.
What do I do?
Which album was Blue Jean on?
That was Tonight. Tonight. That was the follow-up.
Yeah.
And he had no idea what to do. He was now, for the first time in his life, not really a popular cult artist, but he was a megastar, as Kev said. And I think it took him a while to find himself after that album. But to me, Let's Dance is a great pop album.
Oh, great.
Whereas I think Tonight and Never Let Me Down, as much as I like those albums, I'm a Bowie fan.
Yeah.
The average bloke on the street is not going to download those albums.
No.
I was looking at the top 100 albums today, because obviously it's just Bowie in the iTunes top 100.
Yeah.
Those two are conspicuous by their absence.
Yeah. I couldn't believe that I was looking on a Bowie site today, and they'd had a reader's poll on what was the 10 best Bowie albums, and Low was the number one album.
Well, I can see why, because that is my favourite album. And I think with time...
It's my second, Dave.
People,
yeah, I can't believe that.
One thing I will say is I actually envy Mark, because he, in the early 2000s, saw a tour that Bowie did where he played, was it?
Low and Heaven.
Low and Heaven.
From start to finish.
And you've
and
got a
Heaven
great
start to finish.
David Heaven. Badiel anecdote, which I'm going to ask you to tell now.
I can't remember the David Badiel anecdote. He was there at the show. I remember
he
that.
He was gabbing all the way through Heroes.
He
and you had
that.
To inform him that you were at a David Bowie concert, mate.
Yes.
Shut up.
It was during the encore. You're
David
right.
Badiel.
Yeah. Because it was full of celebs.
Yeah.
And I remember that gig. It was like, you know, he was playing this Meltdown Festival. He was curating a Meltdown Festival. And he was finished off at the Royal Festival Hall with him doing a gig. I didn't get a ticket. And in the same way I paid a few hundred pounds to watch the Arsenal Champions League final in Paris, I paid a few hundred quid to watch this gig. Luckily, I'm at the Arsenal match. It wasn't a forgery. I got in.
Yeah.
And so when you pay a lot of money for that kind of ticket, you want to be able to watch the show. But going back to Kev's point, it was a brilliant gig. He came on, did Low from start to finish, and it was just magnificent. Then did Heaven, an album that I really like.
Love Heaven.
From start to finish.
Very underrated album.
Yeah, and then came back and did 10 hits. Afterwards, for an encore, 3-hour performance, what a show. It was phenomenal, apart from David Badil believing all the way through it.
And he was just chatting to his mum all the way through.
You're right. Do you know what? Some things you suppress from your memory.
Because you need to blank them out.
In
really.
My mind, but now it's all come flooding back. Yeah, thanks. And he's been tweeting all day, David Badil. I can tweet you back and just say,
bloody well listen when the man was alive.
Yeah, absolutely.
However, to get back to the point about Lowe, I mean, obviously, it's like when you've got a Player of the Year vote and you've got three Man United players in it, the votes get split. But the thing about Lowe is that on side one, there are some fantastic tracks. And with time, people who are just repeated listening have got into the electronic stuff on side two. And as a set of compositions, it is a fantastic mood album. And... you know, I mean, a track like Be My Wife, for example, you know, absolutely fantastic.
Sound and Vision, always crashing the same car. What a song.
It's a great song, it's good, but are they any better than the stuff on Hunky Dory?
Well, it's a subjective.
Quicksand,
it's subjective,
Brothers,
but that shows Bages, you
are
what
you pretty things, Life on Mars.
Difficult.
Prettiest Star. Like, absolutely. Yeah.
Prettiest Star?
That's Star's on Aladdin Sane.
Yeah.
But it could have been on Hunky Dory.
Aladdin Sane is a great
In
album.
Fact, the Prettiest Star was written for Hunky Dory. It was carried forward.
It was. It was written in 1970 when Mark Bolan played guitar. It was a follow-up to Space Oddity.
Yeah.
But going back to Low, I adore Low, Kev, and I agree with you. It's probably in my top three, but my top three change all the time.
Yeah.
Whereas Ziggy Stardust, which I know you like a lot, Steve.
Yeah.
I love that album.
Yeah.
And it's the one that's currently, apart from his current album, I think it's number two now in the iTunes charts.
Yeah.
It's the go-to album. But I think both albums that go around it, Hunky Dory and
Man Who Sold the World.
Love Insane. I'd argue are better than Ziggy.
Yeah. Crack Baby Crack. Show me your real
time. What a song is time?
Baby suck. It's All That You Feel.
Cracked Actor.
Yeah.
Lady Grinning Soul.
Yeah.
Mike Garson solo on that song, on the piano.
She'll come.
How good is that?
Well, I mean, you know, I heard Bowie's version of Let's Spend the Night Together before I heard the Stones one. And when I heard the Stones one, obviously the original, yeah, I just thought, this is so tame.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't compare with the Bowie version.
I remember in 1973, when Aladdin Sane came out, my mum and dad had frequent foreign holidays, and I never went with them. I always used to stay in the house on my own. And I had a habit of throwing my bedroom windows wide open, and I had massive Wharfdale speakers at the time, and I used to play Bowie at full blast so you could hear it right across the neighbourhood in those days. That's what you did. Never had headphones or anything then. And the louder that you played your music, the more kind of like kudos you got. And I remember playing Aladdin Sane, you know, Crack Baby Crack, Watch That Man, Aladdin Sane, you know, all of those big rock tracks.
Gene Genie
on that album. Absolutely full blast. And in my mind, I was David Bowie on stage playing those tracks to the whole neighbourhood in Banstead in Surrey. If anyone's still alive and you heard it, it was me.
Did you ever see him live, Kev?
I saw him only three times, unlike yourself. I saw him on the Let's Dance tour at Wembley Arena. Very lucky to get tickets for that, actually.
Before it moved to stadiums, that was in his early...
Yes, and it was a great show. I saw the Glass Spider tour at Wembley Stadium.
Was it raining, Kev?
I think it was, actually.
Two rainy gigs.
Yeah. I went to that gig, but I don't remember it raining.
Oh, there's one night.
I remember starting off in the light, and by the time the concert finished, it was dark. And I thought it should have started later, so it was all in the dark. But we the following Wednesday, me and Tony Madden, hi Tony, we drove up to Main Road and watched the same concert, the Glass Spider Tour, at Main Road in Manchester. And that actually started about 8 o'clock at night. So we did see the whole Glass Spider concert in the dark. And my God, it was absolutely brilliant. Tony texted me today to say, do you remember Glass Spider, Main Road, 1987? And that bit where... El Slick, is it?
No, it was Carlos Alomar.
Carlos Alomar, where he's doing that guitar solo. Yeah, that's it.
And the dancers come down from the top of the stage.
And Bowie keeps interrupting him, doesn't he?
Yeah. Shut up!
That's it, yeah. And then he stops, looks all around, acts as if to say, what's that? Yeah. Starts again. And then Bowie goes, shut up! And then he comes down, doesn't he, on that chair.
No, then it's four dancers come down, first of all, and do some chant, and do Up the Hill backwards.
Yeah.
And then Bowie comes down on the chair to the Glass Spider song.
On the phone.
Yeah, and then Peter Frampton comes out with his big hair. It's like,
That's it. Do you know what? When Bowie comes down, you know, in the Zainwine province. And then, the goosebumps, they're still coming up now. 40 years later, they're still coming up. 30 years later, is it? 30 years later. The goosebumps are still coming up now. And when he hits the stage and then just goes into that first song. I mean,
and that's regarded as his worst ever tour. Yes. Yeah, I've watched that video.
I think that's his best tour.
I've watched that video where I think it's filmed at the Sydney Entertainment Centre, wherever it is.
Yeah.
At the time, a billion times I watched that.
Yeah.
And those crazy dancers.
Yeah.
One was called Spaz Attack. Wouldn't get away with calling a dancer that now, would you, really?
Yeah. And the make believe girl that comes up on stage, she's really a plant.
For a bang bang, yeah.
That's it, yeah. She does the dance.
Mr. Hurley,
yeah. Me? Oh, no. Hey, not me. Hey, me. Yes, you. I mean, God, it's just so. I mean, innovative.
Yeah.
You go to a concert now, and you get a load of guys in jeans that just stand there and play boring music. And they just stand there, and you're supposed to be entertained. Well, I mean, Bowie didn't only entertain you, he took you to another planet.
Yeah. And even though that tour was heavily criticised, people like Madonna, Prince, all took massive chunks of that thing and nicked it.
Yeah, especially Madonna.
So it pioneered loads of stadium gigs afterwards, even though it was slated at the time.
I love that concept.
Did you like it, Kev, at the time, or do you find it a bit OTT? Was you slightly more reticent at the time, being a cool young hipster?
Well, the thing that interested me about that tour was Bowie took a risk. You know, he'd established his reputation as this stadium gig performer and then came on with this set that your average rugby fan, for want of a better phrase, of a stadium gig attendee, wouldn't have known about 90% of the material. So credit to him for doing that. And it almost killed him commercially. But then he had to come back with the Sound of Vision tour to just basically compensate and make sure he kept his audience on board.
Was the Sound Division tour after the Glass
Blind? It was 1990.
Yes. And he guaranteed it hits.
People had to vote for what song they wanted to hear. Because there was that was my first gig.
There was a period, I think, just before Glass Spider, where Bowie went very sexy. And, you know, when he would do the hits on his tours before Glass Spider, but where there would have been a guitar solo, like in Moonage Daydream or something like that, there would be a sax solo.
That was Serious Moonlight.
Yeah.
That was Serious Moonlight.
Yeah, and when I went to see the Glass Spider and the guitars came back, I was over the moon to hear the guitars back.
Because you didn't tour between 83 and 87. Yeah. So the one Kev saw him at, at Wembley, that was with the saxophones, with the Lenny and Steve Pickett.
Yeah, I wasn't
with Dornier horns, playing the horns.
I must admit, that's my probably weakest Bowie period.
Whereas Sound and Vision, that Kev mentioned there, he was right. That was when he basically said, I'm going to retire my back catalogue, which he pretty much did for 10 years or so. I didn't play the hits for a long, old time.
But it was,
I would play a two-hour set of back-to-back hits and favourites, but that's it. And after this, they've gone for like ever.
Yeah.
Which they did do.
Yeah.
And that was my first gig. That was Wembley Arena for me. Not Wembley Arena.
My third gig was actually the tour after that. The one that Morrissey started supporting.
Outside tour.
And I saw a Wembley Arena there. And I thought the start of that gig, when Bowie wanders on halfway through the first song, which is the slow one. I can't remember what it's even called.
My Death, was it? Something like that? Motel, I think he did at the start.
Yeah, it was just wonderful. I mean, it really was a great intro, because it was just built up and he suddenly was there, and that was a good show, I remember.
But that was another tour, Kevin, even that one you're into, is that tour got maligned because he came on and did Outside pretty much, obscure
stuff. But having said that, if you know your Bowie back catalogue, there were some gems there, and that's what makes it interesting. You know, I still go and see U2 when they tour, once, one show every tour. And when they play Pride, or where the streets have no name, I think, I've heard this too many times, I'm bored of it. I actually like hearing the unusual songs, or the new songs.
Yeah.
With Bowie, more often than not, you would get that. So if you were actually a big Bowie fan, you would get something from those gigs, which wasn't just repetition.
See, I didn't see that leg of the Outside tour. I went to the Earthling tour and I saw a lot of gigs. But what was that like, Kev? Was the audience into it?
Some were, some weren't. I mean, certainly, the way it was done, he never sort of got that groundswell of just taking the audience with him. And that's probably why it was a bit of a smaller tour. Everyone ever went to stadiums.
No,
it was just arenas.
If I remember right, the outside there was no stage effects.
But there was lots of
just Bowie on stage.
There was lots of like drapes and various kind of hologram things. There wasn't a really elaborate stage.
The antithesis of Glass Spider. It was a bit more basic.
Yeah, and he was in dressed down dungarees and stuff like that.
Now, can anyone remember what the old guy who narrated a lot of Outside? Bowie talking in an old man's voice. What was his name? What was that guy's
name? Touch Shriek or something.
That's it. Arnold Touch Shriek.
Hello, I'm a man on the worldwide internet.
Arnold Touch Shriek. If you go back to that Outside album now, like 15 years later or whatever it is, I mean there are some
20 years
brilliant
later,
tracks on there. And Hello Space Boys from that.
Yeah, I'm trying to tell you, I think that album's 22 years old, Steve.
22, is it?
Yeah, 93.
God almighty.
But that, funny enough, Juanino tweeted today.
Yeah.
And they were saying that
one of them. Bye bye, love.
Because obviously,
When Strangers When We Meet is one of his finest records. Yeah.
But Eno was saying today that him and Bowie were chatting about that album recently, saying it fell through the cracks. They both loved that album.
Yeah.
And they were talking about trying to work out a way to bring it back.
Yeah.
And those Siegs are controversial with the little voices and the characters.
Yeah, yeah.
That's got some amazing songs on that Outside album.
Absolutely.
I love it.
Absolutely.
Oh, well, when I went to the Bowie exhibition in 2013 at the Victorian
Bowie Museum,
and there was a bank of videos, and there was a different Bowie video on all these little mini TV screens, all in one big bank, and you could press a button and home in on one of them, and I just homed in on that Hello Space Boy with the Pet Shop Boys. And if you listen to it, it has to be the Pet Shop Boys version, because they do bring something to the party.
Oh yeah, it's a good version.
It's one of the best Bowie tracks ever. Hello Space Boy with Pet Shop Boys. And you can play that at home in front of anyone when you're having a dinner party or you've got friends around. You put that track on, everyone loves it. Brilliant track.
That was a great track. But that's got some really difficult material on that album.
Yeah.
Had it been released now, I think it would have gone down really well.
Yeah.
But at the time, he wasn't the critic's darling.
And ahead of his time.
Do you know what everyone said about Hello Space Boy as well? Ah, it's like Space Oddity revisited for the 21st century or whenever it was. Yeah.
Okay.
Or the late 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And he even sang it in a kind of like space folk
Motley Cockney accent. But that was, yeah, that was a great album.
Yeah.
But that was maybe was the start of his artistic comeback.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I totally agree. Mm. And there's an album that everyone totally forgets.
Buddha of Suburbia, Steve. No?
Love Buddha of Suburbia. There's some fantastic tracks on that. The one with the one round about Buddha of Suburbia, it's a bit of an R&B. Black Tie, White Noise.
Number one album, though.
Discuss. Black Tie, White Noise.
Not my favourite. It's probably in my bottom five.
It's the one that everyone forgets.
Along with Young Americans.
Do you remember that one?
Because it's a bit
vaguely,
soul-y.
Vaguely.
But it's got, once again, even though it's not my favourite album, there's four or five tracks in that album that I adore. Jump, They Say, the single.
That's it,
is
yeah, yeah,
a brilliant song. His cover of Morrissey's Know It's Gonna Happen Someday.
Yeah.
Brings tears to your eyes.
Yeah.
What an amazing song.
Yeah.
That's very sax heavy, so do you like it, Steve? I imagine it's a very...
It's not my worst Bowie album.
It's a very dancey album.
Yeah, it's not my worst Bowie album. I could easily listen to it and enjoy it, you know, despite the fact that a lot of the tracks are very saxy.
I will go back to it today, but if I put it on, I enjoy listening to it.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely.
But just imagine this, okay? You're a young person who loves their music, and you've just heard about this guy, David Bowie, and this is what makes me jealous of young people now. They are about to discover, if they want to pursue it, this huge back catalogue, and they've got years of pleasure ahead of themselves.
Oh,
and that, in a way, is the legacy that some of these artists that we're losing now are leaving behind. And not many of them like Bowie, who would provide quite so much.
They're about to hear the wild-eyed boy from Free Cloud for the first time.
Yeah.
Do you know what? That's a very good point, Kev, because in a way, like I said to you guys before, I came into Bowie, you know, after all his 70s output had been done. So go back to your point, Steve, about I couldn't afford an album every week or going on iTunes now and downloading it or streaming it. So once a month, once I saved up enough pocket money, I'd go and buy a Bowie album.
Yeah.
So every month or two or three, I was hearing a new Bowie album for the first time and going, well, which one do I get? Diamond Dogs, Young Americans, Station to Station. And imagine how exciting that was as an early teen young lad getting really into music.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I was 16 I finished collecting every Bowie album.
Yeah.
That was a massively exciting time.
Absolutely. It was like me going back to The Man Who Sold the World and the first David Bowie album.
The Speculative one,
Well, and I mentioned that Wide-Eyed Boy from Free Cloud is because it was the B-side of Space Oddity, the single. And I loved it then. And I still love it 40-odd years later. It's bloody brilliant. Every track on that Space Oddity album is superb.
There's a song which goes on for 7-8 minutes. Signet Committee, is it called?
Signet Committee, yeah.
Amazing track.
Yeah, yeah. And what's that one? the Signet Committee it's an anthem at the end of it, isn't there? Like some Buddhist thing.
It's not the one that goes, "Sun Machine is coming down."
That's it.
Memory of a free festival.
Coming down.
Yeah.
And we're gonna have a party.
The sun. He played the first Glastonbury.
It was played the first. It was written about the Beckenham Arts Festival. There's an amazing version of that song, Steve. Have you got it?
Yeah.
It's the first song you ever performed with Mick Ronson.
Right.
And there's an alternative version where it's not parts one and two.
Yeah.
Like a long 7-minute version of it.
Yeah.
Which is a bonus track on the reissue of Man Who Sold the World.
Yeah.
That's a phenomenal version.
Now, why does no current artist, as far as I'm aware, I don't hear every single record. Why does no one these days make a record as good as The Sun Machine?
It's a subjective statement, Steve. I'm sure you ask young people, they would say different.
There just isn't, is there?
Well, not for us.
No.
There isn't.
Yeah.
Now, that is, no one is ever going to make records as good as
Bowie. But you could argue, though, Kev, that I was of a different generation slightly. You and Steve, only by 10 years or so.
Mm.
But in the 80s, you know, I had a plethora of acts to choose from, but I had to go back to essentially what was a 70s artist. And in the same way that my sister, that's 4 years younger than me, perhaps it was because of her brother, but she adores Bowie.
Yeah.
And when you were watching him in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was quite a lot of young kids there. So, of course, I imagine they're still listening to modern-day bands. But he did span generations.
Yeah.
It wasn't like it was just a bunch of old fuddy-duddies going to watch him live.
No.
Well, what's happening also, you've got to remember, is that presumably in the domestic environment, you know, parents are playing records and the kids are getting influenced. Now, I remember when I was young, you know, my father would play someone like Jim Reeves and I just couldn't connect with that.
No.
Now, maybe because Bowie is a more interesting musician, then, you know, kids that live with parents that play this stuff get into it and then end up going along and you know. I mean, the Rolling Stones is a very classic example of that. You go to a Rolling Stones show now, you will see a lot of people who are like not even 30 years old, you know. And basically, the Stones probably haven't made a decent record for 30 years, but, you know, because they've rediscovered all their old stuff, they're really into the shows.
And do you know what I've noticed working at Sony as well with a lot of young kids? I'm by far the oldest person that works there. You see these 25, 26, 27-year-old kids sitting there. They've got every modern album, every modern artist to play on their PCs during their day at work. And what do we hear more than anything else? Beatles, Stones, Roxy Music, Pink Floyd, Bowie. They're all playing that. You know, it seems to be a bit of a thing with young kids these days to discover and enjoy 70s music.
Well, even, I mean, that's the case, is, I guess, going back to your point, Kev, that, you know, you can't really say there's a huge lineage between Jim Reed and David Bowie, whereas you can spot the influence. I mean, back in the 90s, when I was, you know, 18, 20, bands like Blur and Suede and Pulp sounded like David Bowie.
Yeah.
So you'd think, do you know what, I'm going to go back to the 70s to hear where these bands came from.
Yeah.
And there was this kind of, you know, you could see the influence. I mean, Boys Keep Swinging, sorry, was it M.O.R. by Blur?
Yeah.
Is a rip-off of Boys Keep Swinging.
And David Albarn adopted Bowie's style of singing.
Yeah. And so if you were growing up at that time, you automatically went to Bowie to check out where your favourite band came from. I mean, look at Suede. They had a whole career based on David Bowie.
Yeah, absolutely. That's Spandau Ballet.
Well, loads of bands in the 80s did, right? All the Romantics and everything else.
Mm. Yeah. In fact, we might as well just say that Bowie influenced everything. Didn't
he certainly was very, very influential in certainly the popular culture of English music, British music, since really. I mean, did he start glam rock, really?
I think so.
Well, Bowie, you could argue.
Maybe or Mark Bowie.
You could argue between the two of them, couldn't you, really?
Yeah.
I think Bowie took it to another level.
In fairness, Bowie appeared in the dress on Man Who Sold the World. Did he have makeup on there? Certainly had long hair and looked very effeminate.
1970, that was as well, wasn't it?
So, you know, there was an element of that there. You know, wasn't afraid to experiment with makeup and whatnot, and that led to sort of glam rock. I mean, Roxy Music presumably got a bit from Bowie when they started off.
I remember seeing that famous Rainbow gig in 1972.
Oh, you had that, Steve, was you?
When I was at that.
Seriously?
Bowie debuted Ziggy Stardust.
Because it was with Lindsay Kemp doing all the mime stuff there as well.
And in the Rainbow Theatre in those days, there was a fountain, you know, in the foyer there. I think it's still there now, but obviously derelict. And went in there. I was a huge Bowie fan at that time. I just about got into him from the current albums, Man Who Sold the World, Hunky Dory, and those ones. They weren't as massive as they became after Ziggy Stardust. Ziggy Stardust made those albums, because once... Yeah. Everyone got into Ziggy, they just bought the back catalogue. But I remember Roxy Music came on first, they supported Bowie, did Pajama Armour and Virginia Plain and all the tracks from the first album. I immediately became a Roxy Music fan that night as well. And that love of Roxy Music has never left me either, but, you know, when Bowie came on, you know, Hang On To Yourself, gin, 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 and the classical music that they used to play.
From Beethoven, from Clockwork Orange.
That's it, yeah. And Bowie would just come on, and the lightning strikes across the stage. You know, the lighting, you know, the lightning strike he had across his face on Aladdin Sane. The lightning was always Bowie's kind of trademark in those days, and the Ziggy Stardust tours were typified by lightning strikes across the stage all the time. I remember seeing that for the first time, you know, that Ziggy Stardust at the Rainbow, and hearing the album and just loving every minute of it, and the way he pranced around the stage and did the Lindsay Kemp mime, and, you know, it was just awesome. And I went to see that tour three more times.
Did you really see it?
Yeah. I think definitely Fairfield Hall's Croydon, and maybe the Hammersmith Odeon as well, which was the year before he announced his retirement.
The retirement one, second and third,
Still my greatest memories of concerts, and I've seen millions of concerts over the years.
All right, well, let's talk briefly and just compare our thoughts on the albums that followed that whole Ziggy period, okay? Mm. So basically you had Diamond Dogs, and then you had
Young Americans,
and then you had Station to Station.
Yeah. Ooh. Diamond Dogs.
Incredible that, he should go through the amount of changes in style over such a short period of time.
In 3 years, it's one album a year.
Exactly, and all good records. I think my favourite would be Station to Station out of those three.
Well, that came second to Low in this poll.
Is that right? Okay.
Station to Station was second.
But Diamond Dogs, I think, is an underrated record. And it's got a lot of really, really brilliant songs on it.
Diamond Dogs is probably my second favourite Bowie album.
With Sweet Thing, Candidate, and Sweet Thing Reprise, that 10-minute section of that album is simply sublime.
I totally agree. You know, that first track... You know, and in the death, in the thoroughfare, you know.
And that, of course, should have been called, that album should have been called 1984.
Yeah.
You couldn't get permission from George Orwell's wife, could he?
Right. And then the Eurythmics. The Eurythmics
managed to get it. What did he call it, 1984? Couldn't get permission.
He wanted to do a musical from 1984.
Yeah.
George Orwell's wife and estate wouldn't give him permission.
Oh, didn't
so he rewrote it into... Diamond Dogs.
He had the track 1984, but he couldn't make the album 1984 because it was like a concept based on the book.
But at the Bowie Is thing, you saw the whole kind of stage sets that he made of like how it would look and how the whole kind of, he turned it into a stage show.
Yeah.
But it got obviously knocked to one side.
He did Diamond Dogs after Ziggy Stardust, didn't he?
After Aladdin Sane.
It was a progression of sorts.
And then he became quite theatrical then.
Because Diamond Dogs.
That was around about the time of that documentary, that. Cracked Actor.
Which I think is available in full on YouTube still.
It's a great documentary.
But we never saw Diamond Dogs tour in the UK, did we?
No.
And
halfway through, he burnt the set and went all soul and disbanded it halfway through because he got bored.
Yeah. Well, that's probably because he was playing a lot of sax and trumpet and stuff instead of a guitar.
He didn't do any instruments at all on that tour.
Yeah.
It was all acting. Yeah. It was very heavily staged.
Yeah.
But that's when he was off his face on coke. Yeah. When you watch that Cracked Actor, he is not on this planet. It's a brilliant documentary.
It's so skinny as well.
Yeah, he lived on milk and peppers, apparently.
Yeah, blimey.
But album-wise, I agree with you, Kev. Are those three, I love Diamond Dogs. Young Americans is probably my least favourite of the classic albums. Station to Station, I know it's only six tracks, but not a bad track on it.
No, absolutely.
And Wild is the Wind and Word on a Wing as well.
Yes.
It's brilliant album. Phenomenal.
Not in my top five.
I love it. And the song Station to Station.
Oh,
the way it just builds.
Yes.
That 10-minute cavalcade.
But that, in a way, you know, it's like Sound of Vision. You've got this wonderful musical intro, and then finally he comes in. And he is a master at building stuff up if he wants to.
Yeah.
And you know, it's interesting. I mean, I've only heard for the first time today, Black Star, and you know, it is interesting to me. The sheer amount of musicality on it, he's still experimenting, you know, even at this stage. And that's the one thing that's really taken me aback about Bowie as an artist, that in his late 60s, he was still able to create innovative music, you know, exploring stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at other peers of his... You know, I don't think the Rolling Stones have made an album for over 10 years anyway, but they just kept touring because they don't have that creative juices anymore.
Yeah.
And in a way, perhaps that is what sets Bowie apart from most of his peers, that A, he's kept being creative, but B, with such a huge amount of variety in the music that he's brought out, because he's done most of the styles, you know.
Did you ever see the video for Black Star, Kev?
I have not watched it yet.
It's insane, isn't it?
Insane. But with the minute I watched it, I thought there's an analogy here with what's going on in the Middle East, like with ISIS and stuff. Huge kind of misogyny issues there, you know, where the women are all alluded to have been killed and executed and stuff. There's all that stuff with crucifixions in the video. And I kind of thought, this is all about ISIS. And today, someone on one of the obituaries has said that Black Star video was Bowie's interpretation of ISIS and the situation in the Middle East. And he did it so brilliantly.
It's absolutely a phenomenal. It's like a 10-minute video. It's like a mini film.
Yeah, yeah.
It cost a lot to make, I would imagine.
That's interesting because he was never political, if you think about it, really.
Apart from his supposed fascist salute.
Well, I think that was... more of a I don't think he really thought about that very heavily.
I think that was a drug thing more than anything else. Yes. But you're right, Kev. He wasn't. He didn't really kind of. Apart from some Tin Machine songs, had a bit of social poetry on there. Mm. But you know, he was going through a funny period.
Do you know when I was 16? I'll give my little Bowie story. When I was 16, I was obviously a massive football fan, and I loved Bowie so much. Not so much now, but in those days, Bowie and Arsenal occupied my every waking moment, and Teresa Farrington as well.
presumably some young lady
Teresa
you knew.
Farrington was a lady I knew at the time.
Right. Fair enough.
Although she wasn't so much a lady in those days. We were only 16. I remember writing to the Bowie fan club and saying, oh, I'm such a Bowie fan, love him, you know, he's just brilliant. Is he into football? And if so, what football team does he support? Hoping upon hope the letter would come back saying, oh, he's a big Arsenal fan. And they came back saying, David isn't particularly interested in... I got a handwritten letter back. David isn't particularly interested in football, but if he was, he would support Tottenham Hotspur.
I think hopefully that was a cheeky PR person who happened to be a spud.
But it never put me off.
You think Willie's from...
Never put me off in the slightest.
You'd imagine being more Crystal Palace, really, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would.
He's from that area.
Yeah. So I imagine that the person that wrote that fan club letter was probably a Spurs fan. I probably thought, well, I'll just say Spurs.
So, I mean, when was he sort of big in the States, really? I mean...
75 is when he broke through.
Right.
When he did Young Americans and Fame. That was his first number one.
Right, but then they didn't really get the Berlin stuff, did they?
No.
You know, and he had to sort of come back in the 80s with that Let's Dance album.
Well, his highest charting album in the States, funnily enough, was the next day that got to number two.
Wow.
Up to that point, he had a number four, number five album, but he'd never enjoyed a number one. I think Bon Jovi just kept him off the top spot the next day. That was his highest charting.
Would you say that
the Let's Dance album not did that, no,
number
really, yeah?
four? I think they got to. Right. I could be wrong, but it didn't get to number one.
Right,
I know that much.
Would it be fair to say the Americans never really got Bowie?
Not to the level we probably.
No, they probably still had Dolly Parton at number one in those days.
Hmm.
I think
he did decent sized performances.
Yes, yeah, but there's just a more sort of conservative audience in a way. So you know, it's interesting that you know. Some UK artists managed to make it big over there, but perhaps because he was a bit too left field, and perhaps because he didn't play formula music, that he would change his style so frequently, that he never built up what you call it, the huge following that he had in this country.
You'd probably argue he was a huge, huge, huge cult artist.
Well, in a way, it's like they say that everyone who heard a Velvet Underground record in the 60s ended up forming a band. You can see from the tributes that have come in today that a lot of actual musicians were obviously huge admirers, and it's probably because they could see what he was doing and has done as genius, because he did cover most of the bases. And do them very well. I mean, you know, he was. I remember seeing a video. I thought it was Cracked Actor. I don't think it was. That was. It was too early. But when he was doing Young Americans, teaching Luther Vandross the background vocal parts, you know, as a white guy telling a black guy how to sing black music.
Yeah.
You know, it just shows you how, in a sense. Gifted he was.
Bowie sings brilliantly on that album, Young Americans.
Yes.
The falsettos he reaches, incredible. The high notes he gets to.
Well, he was the first white artist to play on Soul Train, wasn't he?
Yeah, the US TV show,
which
you're right.
Something you'll never take away from him. And it also shows the respect that, you know, the black music fraternity had for him, that he was able to achieve that.
Did you ever see that interview he did with the American chat show host? Was it Jay Leno? Where it was just before Diamond Dogs or during Diamond Dogs, where he came on in the light
blue suit.
Dick Cavett.
Dick Cavett,
that's the one. And he comes on with the cane. And he's mucking about with the cane all the time. And he's just prodding with it and mucking about with it. And he's totally out of his head off the cane. And Dick Cavett is clearly furious with Bowie being evasive and taking the piss out of him. And Dick Cavett did not get the British humour or the British... I mean, Dick Cavett was sitting there thinking, oh my God, this guy really is an alien. I'm used to American actors and American kind of musicians and stuff. This guy, Bowie, what's he doing coming on my show and just, you know, hitting me with his cane and stuff? And fascinating.
Is this on YouTube?
Okay, it's on YouTube. It is phenomenal. Steve's right. It's the height of his drug period. And he's getting interviewed on what essentially was primetime American television. And he's like drawing pictures of his cane on the floor. It's a brilliant piece of TV.
Totally not interested.
But as is the Russell Harty interview. So that one where he's live by satellite.
Yeah.
And Russell Harty from 73. So he's a Ziggy then. He's interviewing via satellite.
Yeah.
And he's in the Bahamas somewhere. And Russell Harty knows nothing about David Bowie at all.
No.
And Bowie gets more and more cross as the interview goes on. Decides that they take the piss out of Russell Harty. It's a fantastic piece of television. Yeah. That's on YouTube as well. Yeah. That's a phenomenal piece of TV.
Two total kind of prehistoric monsters from the 50s. As the, you know, they've had the 1970s Coke culture, you know, glam rock culture just thrust in their face. And they don't know what to do with it, do they? I mean, the Dick Cavett one is incredible because he's clearly furious with Bowie.
Yeah, it's bonkers.
Yeah, you know, he's still alive, Dick Cavett. I wonder if you asked him now, in retrospect, you know, what did you make of that video? You know, what was that TV show like at the time? How did you feel, you know? And how do you feel in retrospect now, you're 80-odd and Bowie's dead, you know?
Mm.
Amazing. So, I mean, one final question, because I don't know...
We've got to wrap up. Yeah, well, you know, we can go for another few minutes.
Okay. Elvis, Bowie.
Mm-hmm.
I've never got Elvis.
Mm.
You know, when I grew up, Elvis was a massive, massive superstar. A bit like Kev goes with Jim Reeves, parents' generation. Elvis was always my parents' generation, not mine. Never really got into Elvis at all, but 40 years after he's died, he's still as popular as ever. In fact, you know, Bowie's about to knock him off number one spot. So... 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, is Bowie going to have the same status that Elvis has currently got?
No, not in America, certainly. I mean, Elvis was a cultural icon in a different kind of way, because what Elvis symbolised really was the end of austerity and the beginning of liberalism. Now, what Bowie did was come in when the idea of liberalism started to be established and encourage people that they could go a bit further. And I actually have to say this, you know, I mean, we are under an Arsenal umbrella recording this, although it's specifically for Bowie fans to listen to, but Arsene Wenger said in his press conference today, very, you know, very classily, that basically the thing Bowie did was encourage people to be themselves and, you know, sod the boundaries in a way, you know, have some self-belief and some self-confidence in what you are and what you want to do and express yourself. And I think in a sense Bowie's legacy on that level, certainly in this country and possibly in Europe, was far greater than Elvis for that. And I think what will happen is that, you know, his music will continue to be appreciated and his records will continue to be played, because, you know, he just did all these different styles so well and he was such an innovator that I don't think time is going to actually alter that perception.
Time is waiting in the wings.
He speaks of
senseless things. His like script is you and me.
Boy.
Time.
I think it might be time to wind it up.
I actually think Bowie will be more relevant than Elvis going forward.
Possibly.
Because today's generation, the kids growing up today...
Elvis was an interpreter of songs.
Yeah.
Elvis was a singer, a bit like Sinatra.
Yeah.
You know, Bowie was a creator.
Mm.
You know, Bowie actually set his own agenda.
Wrote his own music.
Exactly. So they're different kind of individuals. Both have had huge influence in their different ways. But ultimately, Elvis was an entertainer.
Yeah.
Whereas Bowie was someone who you could argue shifted cultural development just by his influence on so many in so many ways. And certainly I think in the UK was ultimately a lot more significant.
Have you ever seen that Blue Jean video?
Yes, Julian Temple. I've seen that, and there's a 30-minute version where he plays the kind of nerd, but then plays the obviously main pop star guy as well.
But that, to me, that sums up Bowie. Modest. I mean, he was never. I mean, this last 10 years kind of sums him up. Never really been, you know, I'm the great superstar. I'm the great man. He's always kept a relatively low profile, even in the '70s. I mean, even on stage, he was very reluctant to kind of identify with the audience. You were lucky if he identified the band, and you know maybe.
And I will say this though. Yeah. You know, I remember about 2 years ago, I watched a video. I think it was one of the songs from Lodger, but basically he was on the street walking along.
DJ.
And he was basically amongst the people, and he handled it so well because these guys were all over him, following around and almost, you know, molesting him almost. But he just fronted it, and you sensed he was actually enjoying it. So I think on one level he could mix with his public if he wanted to.
Yeah.
But at the same time, part of his character was not to give too much of himself away. And keep himself very private. You know, I think that's
that Blue Team video when he plays the alter ego.
Yes.
And the David
it's very Bowie, naff. Isn't
the girlfriend the girlfriend is so in awe of this character on stage, Blue Jean, and her boyfriend is that guy, but not dressed up as the stage character, just as an ordinary bloke.
Mm-hmm.
And Bowie says to the girlfriend, "Hey, you know, like, what about me? What about me?" And she's just in awe of this guy on stage. And the guy next to her is really Bowie. And, you know, like this modest character that really is him.
Amazing trivia fact for you, Steve. The guy playing bass in that video is one of the members from Right Said Fred.
Really? Yeah. Good song. If anyone listening wants to listen to a bit of Bowie retrospective, Blue Jean's the one.
One of the only two songs that he wrote on tonight, funnily enough, along with Loving the Alien, and even though it's his most critically panned album, the two songs he actually wrote that weren't covers or rehash of old Iggy Pop songs, those are two strongest songs on the album.
Loving the Alien, what a great
song. Which showed he still had it in him.
And Absolute Beginners.
Well, what a great
Absolute Beginners. 1985.
With the return of Hootie Steve on the piano. Who did he bring back on piano for the first time since 71?
Mike Dawson?
No. Someone played piano on Hunky Dory and he brought him back.
Rick Wakeman?
Exactly, Kev.
Okay. Rick Wakeman. Blimey.
Played his beautiful piano line on, obviously, because Rick Wakeman was a man on Life on Mars.
Right, okay, we're going to finish now with, and this has been a celebration of Mr. Bowie's life. We're just going to finish with a favourite track and a few words about it. Pick one for your desert
famous
island.
Famous track, Desert Island. There's one Bowie track.
Do you want me to start?
Yes.
One Bowie track.
Even though I like a lot of the more esoteric, avant-garde, difficult numbers, the song I would take on a desert island, by far and away my favourite melody line of all time ever, is Driving Saturday off Aladdin Sane. The perfect pop song. Magnificent.
I love it. Well, I'd probably have to say Life on Mars.
Mm.
Because that is I think that is the song that Bowie's going to be remembered by in generations to come. Like, I mean, it's Beatles, the Stones, it's every famous musician you've ever known. Bowie usurps them all with that song. So I'd say Life on Mars.
Do you know why he wrote that song, Steve?
I don't.
He got asked to write the lyrics to My Way, the Paul Anka song, which Frank Sinatra sung, and they turned it down because he didn't write good enough lyrics. So his response was to get really cross and angry. He got turned down to write.
Yeah.
And Life on Mars was his version of My Way.
Really?
And he uses the same chord structure.
Really? Fantastic.
He's like anger and
repulsed. I never knew that. You learn something every day. But what a great song.
Amazing song. One of the best songs ever written.
Oh, it is. Absolutely.
Well, I mean, it would change every day probably. But today I'm going to go for Be My Wife because I love that track every time I hear it, and it's just real a mixture of passion and desperation and emotion, and everything is in there, and it is just such a good tune. So that's my selection of.
I also love the Beaulieu Brothers as well.
There's so many. I mean, my other choice was going to be the original version of Cat People, not the album one.
The Giorgio Moroder
version. Exactly, which I think is brilliant piece of music.
An absolute beginner's tune.
I think it was corrupted by the album version, ultimately.
And maybe your insult.
Phenomenal.
So many. Anyway, we are going to wrap it up there. This has been a special edition recorded by the Gooner Podcast Gang because it just so happens three of us are huge Bowie fans and we felt we wanted to celebrate the great man's life.
And it's been quite cathartic.
I'm glad to hear that.
Because when I came in here tonight, I've had a shit day. I couldn't concentrate on anything at work. Just kept thinking of Bowie all day long. So to talk about this, it's been a release. It's been a cathartic exercise.
I totally
agree. To kind of
remember,
get it all out.
My missus didn't want me to leave the house. She thought I was a liability travelling on public transport.
Yeah,
this has
yeah.
been quite a nice thing to do. Yeah. So I hope there's some listeners out there that yeah. might have got the same thing from listening to this.
Yeah,
and they are going back to their kind of records now and putting on their favourite Bowie tracks.
Yeah, and that is the yeah. thing. We've still got the music, so yeah. We'll always have that. Rest in peace, David, and thanks for everything.